Welcome everyone to the Caribbean Science Fiction Network, a celebration of all things fantasy, folklore, speculative fiction, and of course, science fiction.
What you have happening in The Plague Doctors is a combination of the science, which is the health aspect, the medical aspect, but then the social science aspect is, well, let's say this thing happens. How does it create certain types of crises? What can cause certain types of crises to occur? What conditions do you need to have in there?
On this episode of the podcast, I'll be chatting with Karen Lord, the Barbadian writer of the short story, The Plague Doctors.
I was saying, you know, we can use a story to make some comments about public health, because the point of the anthology was to imagine the future of health. So it was, yes, it was a story, but maybe also a little bit of benign propaganda in the sense that you had to use the story to show your readers, this is what it can be like, or if we don't address certain things, this is what it might be like in ways we don't like.
So Karen, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, and thanks so much for inviting me.
Karen, you've established yourself as a household name in Caribbean SF, really, and I suppose it's evidenced by the fact that anytime someone asks me to recommend Caribbean science fiction, your name is one of the first that comes to mind. So it's only natural that I have you here. As it happens, not only are you the writer appropriate to this podcast, but the work we will be discussing, The Plague Doctors, is extremely appropriate to our current time. Now, I usually begin by asking writers to give a brief synopsis of their work, but I'll deviate from that tradition today and ask you instead to describe your journey towards carving out this niche of Caribbean SF. So why SF?
That's a good question. And I think that the only answer really is just that when I was growing up, that was the kind of genre that I enjoyed the most. That was what you would see me reading the most. I know that for some people who maybe don't read speculative fiction as a genre, they are pretty focused on, shall we say, some typical, maybe even stereotypical depictions of fantasy. So they're always thinking Tolkien, they're thinking there's got to be orcs and elves, or they're thinking there's got to be rockets and robots. But if you read widely, you understand it's a lot more than that. I like to tell people that my first introduction to Caribbean SF was in school, doing CXC English. And we had Edgar Middleholzer's My Bones and My Flute. Middleholzer, of course, being a Guyanese writer, set a ghost story in Guyana. And this is a little traumatic to deal with, as a fourth former, but it made quite an impression on me. There are definitely some pretty interesting footsteps, big footsteps that I'm sort of just following in that guided me to this particular niche. I don't even have to tell you, I should think, about people like Nalo Hopkinson and Tobias Bukel, who are contemporaries of mine, but I would say 10 and 20 years in terms of making the advance guard. But as I said, Middleholzer, we're going all the way back to the 50s, the 60s. This is not new. In our literature, we have a lot of speculative elements. Again, because it's a genre that people have sometimes a narrow view of, there's this idea that, you know, if you write speculative fiction, it's the only thing you write. Or if you write speculative fiction, it can't be set in the Caribbean, or it can't be set in, anything that resembles the Caribbean. But if you take a good hard look at some of our literature, we've been dealing with a lot of, fantastical elements. I was so happy when you introduced the podcast and mentioned folklore front and center, because I think that's one of our greatest contributions to Caribbean SF, the power of folklore. And how we use it to not only connect with the past, but to reframe our present and our future.
Now, I believe that the greatness of famous science fiction writers is part measured by their ability to almost predict the future. And I see you doing a similar thing in The Plague Doctors, which was, I think, published in 2019.
That was early 2020, but it was written in 2019. So it was on the very edge of events unfolding.
So can we say 2019 BC, which was before COVID?
for the writing of it, definitely. For the publication, January 2020. By then, I think it had already been named and so forth. So yeah, we're just pushing it. Yeah.
In our time of COVID, this short story is The Plague Doctors. It's eerily prophetic. So I want to get your thoughts on what was the motivation behind writing this story about not just a contagious disease, but something that predates, in a way, or as you say, on the heels of the present pandemic.
So first of all, anytime you're approaching speculative fiction, I always think that one of the greatest foundations is the world building you're going to put into your story. If you're going to go with science fiction, you are in fact leaning on a lot of realist things. Sometimes fantasy leans more on history, but science fiction means you have to have sometimes a nodding acquaintance with some real world things that are happening. It's a combination of knowing your social sciences, but also knowing your history, because if there are certain conditions that arise in a society, certain consequences will just unfold naturally as a result. So what you have happening in The Plague Doctors is a combination of the science, which is the health aspect, the medical aspect. I did, in fact, use a colleague to be my, shall we say, science specialist, medical specialist for this. I said, I need a disease that's going to do X, and I want it to be grounded in science. So that was where the hard science came in. But then the social science aspect is, well, let's say this thing happens. How does it create certain types of crises? What can cause certain types of crises to occur? What conditions do you need to have in there? Now, pandemics are a trope of the genre. They're a staple of the genre. So it's not a new thing to pick up. At the time, I was more curious about public health. I was saying, you know, we can use a story to make some comments about public health, because the point of the anthology was to imagine the future of health. So it was, yes, it was a story, but maybe also a little bit of benign propaganda in the sense that you had to use the story to show your readers this is what it can be like, or if we don't address certain things, this is what it might be like in ways we don't like. Coming at it with that angle, coming at it with the angle of we're going to use a scientifically based crisis, and we're going to look at the social fallout from that. That's how The Plague Doctors came to be. And of course, the main thing is that it's a particular disease that starts off looking relatively benign, but then has a second phase that's deadly. So that means that people start off, especially the so-called developed countries, start off being very complacent about it until it's too late and it's spread too far. And in some ways, that's exactly what happened with COVID, which I was not pleased to see. But in a sense, I was like, okay, it looks like I did my research correctly. These are indeed the things that are happening as a result of this particular type of setup.
Yeah, I mean, you kind of ticked all the boxes, unfortunately or fortunately, in terms of hazmat suits, quarantines, conspiracy theories. So the story was, as I said, it's eerily prophetic. Now, you mentioned the anthology, Take Us to a Better Place, and I want you to talk about how this story, The Plague Doctors, fits into the overall purpose of the collection, Take Us to a Better Place, which is, as you mentioned, concerned with sort of this idea of health and humanity. So I want you to talk about that anthology and the fact that The Plague Doctors is going to be republished in a new anthology. Does this in any way change how readers are encouraged to approach the narrative of Plague Doctors?
Why I find the anthology fascinating is that I called it benign propaganda. That was a little tongue-in-cheek. But let's be serious, and let's say I was actually very impressed with this project. It's a project by the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, which is a health foundation in the U.S., and they are not a publishing house by any stretch of the imagination. Their thing is health. They have various public health related projects. And this excursion into literature was really, I think, something new they were trying, where they were like, you know, this can be part of our outreach. This can be a new way to reach people and have them think about these issues. You know, we're going to use the power of speculative fiction to make people imagine better futures. No, I'm 100% on board with that. That entire concept is one that I really am quite enthusiastic about. So they really just said, imagine the future of health, you know, give us a story that imagines the future of health. And it was nice and open like that. Some people really just think of fiction as, oh, this is entertainment. This is something you're doing when you don't have anything to do. You want to fill your time and you want to relax your brain. That's fine. That's fine. But, you know, literature can have the purpose, as I said, benign propaganda. We're not moralizing. We're not saying, you know, this is a kind of a checklist of things that you must do or you must think. We're just saying, stretch your imagination in this direction. What if? And the what if is the power of it, really. The second anthology it's being republished in is The Best American Science Fiction and Fantasy 2020. And that's going to be out in about a month's time. So it's not usually the case that something gets reprinted again that quickly. But whenever there's an anthology that is specifically a collection of best ofs, it's sort of accepted that it's a way to, you know, sort of bring it to more readers, bring it to more eyes. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation was kind enough to ease their copyright a little bit to allow me to have that reprinted there, because they said to me that it was selected and that they wanted to reprint it. So I was very happy about that. That was quite an honor.
Tied to that overall framing of this story within the idea of taking us to a better place, I wanted you to explain to us, how do you interpret what such a quote-unquote better place might look like, not just as a CSF writer, but a Caribbean writer in general? In other words, what does the future of the Caribbean look like to you?
Well, one of the things that came about as we as a region began to go through the stresses of COVID, and of course we had some serious crises. We had the tourism industry basically cratering. We had issues with shipping and, you know, basically reduced air flight, you know, mail disrupted, all the rest of it. But amid all of that, one of the things that I saw that gave me a lot of hope was how quick we were as nations within CARICOM to help each other. So when somebody had some extra reagent for COVID tests and somebody else was running low, that just got, you know, donated over real quick. When somebody got a batch of vaccines, they were like, you know, let's give some over to our neighbors, and the vaccines got shared out a bit that way. And that is basically the future that I want to see for us. If we can be collaborative and if we can prize competence, I cannot emphasize that enough. If we can really, really celebrate it when people are competent, when people are, you know, when they look at things from a rational, science-based point of view, a lot of what happened with my story, The Plague Doctors, and in real life, was the incompetence of politicians who felt, if I wait long enough, this will just go away.
I like that. It sounds almost like a profound simplicity in the idea of competence. And we see it playing out in the present. So in a sense, the future is now.
It is indeed now. I like the way you said that. And I think that people can get too caught up in the idea of, oh, the future is we need bases on Mars, or the future is we need self-driving cars that are all solar and so forth. I mean, that's all very well and good, but some of the problems we're having right now are problems that we need to solve in our approach, not in the technology we have in hand, but in the way we use the technology. And we just need to focus on that. That's another thing I get very enthusiastic about. So I'm glad you asked that question.
Of course. So they are almost coinciding narratives, where there's the story is almost equal parts a narrative of disease and of the tensions between mainland and island. And I want to ask you, how do both narratives parallel each other, if they do at all, in the story from your perspective? What was your intention here?
I don't know if they parallel per se, but they're both contributing to the environment. And what I mean by that is, who are you responsible for? I mean, they like to talk about, you know, we're all on this planet Earth, we're all on this together, and so on and so forth. We know the reality is not that at all. So you have situations where if you are in a region, Sometimes the microstates of the region are overlooked unless they have, say, a lot of economic power or by virtue of location are very geographically strategically important. You have situations within countries where small towns may feel left out, or where even islands off the coast may feel as if they're being ignored. So it's always possible to imagine either a real island mainland type scenario, or you know, urban rural for that matter, where there's the here's the center of things, here's where all the where the most people are and where most of technology is cutting edge, and we're pouring all of our attention to this. And then there are the people at the literal physical margins, and they're like, what about us? So there's always this question, I think, that I bring to my writing as a Caribbean person, which is we of the microstates know what it is to be overlooked. But what if that overlooking is in itself fatal? In a pandemic, of course, it's fatal. You can't be in a situation where you're like, well, I've taken care of my major cities and I don't have to worry about a thing, because you can get your disease evolving into a new variant in the hinterlands just as easily, the same ones that you've abandoned to their own devices. So you really do have to have some kind of approach that takes in everybody, takes in the center, takes in the margins.
In this story, the tourism industry, like the virus, I want to say, plagues the islands. And for better or worse, is up for debate, really, because, you know, tourism is touted as the economic driver of the Caribbean. Why the mention of the tourism industry? And is it a signal of the crisis brought on by the virus? Or are you extending what it means to be plagued in different associations?
Any mention I made of the tourist industry was in passing. And there was a reason for that. I knew I wanted it set on an island. I knew I wanted there to be some kind of relationship to a mainland, which is not clear. It's not made clear to you whether this island is an independent nation or whether its connection to the mainland is actually a connection of, you know, this is the same country. I purposely left that vague, but I still wanted to make it clear that there was some kind of bond of dependency, as it were. I didn't want to try to set this in a country, in an island and a microstate that was independent and solely dependent and mostly dependent on tourism, because my social sciences background said immediately the economics of that are going to be so fraught that I'm going to be writing a book and not a short story. That's just, it's too much to handle. I need to focus on the health aspect. I need to focus on the fact that they're restricting entry. But I can't focus on, it needs to be an island that by some miracle is self-sufficient in itself. It's not, yes, it's still getting imports and so forth, but you know, that's why I talked about they're able to 3D print a lot of their equipment, and you know, basically it's large, definitely a larger island than Barbados is. You know, they seem to be all right for food. I had to have that in place there because I actually could not picture writing a short story where you had a country that had tourism shut down and then had to deal with the economic fallout. So I always say to people, you know, you talk about the plague doctors being prophetic. The scary thing for me is what I didn't write, because I didn't want to imagine it, because that's actually what's happening to us right now. I was like, I can't imagine a tourism dependent country, nation, having to deal with this. That would be a whole other story. That would be a whole other book. I'm going to have to simplify this. And that's why there's that tenuous connection to the mainland. That's why it's set far enough in the future that 3D printing is a thing, far more a thing than it is right now in the present.
I mean, a tourism-dependent island dealing with a pandemic. I think that's your next novel.
No, I don't think it's my next novel, because I'm already still living it. And let's stop. Let's not go down that road. Come, ask me something cheerful about literature. That's where I should be going with this conversation. What I didn't write does declare that I do feel like the situation we're in right now is untenable.
Something that is much more front and center in the story is the sort of ethics of science. And I want to ask you, how important is this for you as a writer of Caribbean SF to take on the ethics of science?
I think it's a huge thing, because the ethics of science and the whole concept of human rights are often hand in hand. I was reminded of the importance of ethics. The same person who was my sort of specialist for the story, Dr. Adrian Charles, he had complained once about a show which I shall not name, but it was an American show set in a clinic. And, you know, I think doctors are accustomed to watching medical shows on TV and seeing a fair amount of nonsense in terms of procedures and whatever. And they kind of laugh it off, like, yeah, that operation could never happen, or that disease is pure gibberish. And that's not a big deal. But he would always get very angry when a question of ethics was botched. So, and I thought to myself, I understand that, because you're not going to walk into, walk into the surgery and try this totally fictional procedure. You're not going to catch a disease that got invented. But if you see something ethical being portrayed in a way that is not just incorrect, but actively, opposite of what it should be, that does affect how you see things. That does affect you as a person. So I've tried to make sure that the ethics of science, and the ethics of medicine, that the ethics of politics even, is quite clear in my books, even if protagonists do not always keep to them, that they are aware that there are always consequences. And that's what I make sure to have the protagonist of the Plague Doctors face.
I notice a separation between the character Macy's childish innocence and the scientific engineering of the virus by the adults. So I wanted us to talk about that sort of juxtaposition. How do you see it playing out, and was this a deliberate move?
Maisie was a fascinating character for me, and a very important one on several levels, and I'm glad you noticed that. First of all, to have a patient zero who was 5 years old meant that you had occasion to explain the disease as if it could be understood by a five-year-old. So you had that moment where it had to be explained to her clearly, this is what's happening with you and this is what we have to do about it. So that was one aspect. But as you said, there's also this innocence. She is completely relying on the decisions of the adults that have responsibility for her. She cannot say, I will choose this or I will do that. Now, at the time I was writing, I was quite conscious that the anti-vaxxer movement was a thing. And I said, you know, this is not a story about anti-vaxxers, but I have to be very careful. I have this child character. I have these adults that are making decisions for her. And if I do not set it up correctly, it's going to look as if I'm saying something about whether or not you should get your child vaccinated, and that is completely not what I'm doing here. So there was this very fine line that I had to be treading, where what I was really talking about is the ways in which public health impinges on the well-being of people who are innocent, who are powerless, who are not in a position to be able to change things for themselves. That's really what Maisie's character is about. Yes, she's a child, but she's also a child that symbolizes something that we can see in adults throughout the globe.
I'm almost reading an idea again, sort of prophesying a sort of herd immunity. But I want to tread that phrase very carefully as well, because that is a loaded term. But I guess it's just a testament again of how well this story has been crafted, and why it can be relevant for a very long time.
I think that anytime you write a story, you want it to have that kind of longevity, and there's one thing you haven't mentioned that I'm going to talk about that I think is important, and I hope people carry forward, because you were asking me earlier about what I saw the future of the region being, or the future of health in the region especially. In the story, I tried to make it very clear that yes, there are hospitals in place, yes, there are, you know, major labs and what have you, but there's also a network of, shall we say, community health, where there are nurses and nurse practitioners who visit people in their homes, where there are nutritionists and you know, people who are dealing with health and well-being before it gets to the point of either illness or injury, where the protagonist can actually be somebody who has a small lab set up in her home. I mean, it's kind of funny that I did it like that because, again, you know, we didn't know the extent to which we'd be working from home in the COVID days. But, you know, she literally has a setup where she can have a certain level of basic laboratory in her own house and then also have the connectivity to communicate with scientists and medical practitioners around the world and share information. So she's got the access to archives and to information in that way. So you have that level of redundancy so that if something dire does happen, you don't lose everything. There's a backup. A backup is automatically in place. And it's decentralized. So it's not like you hit this one central place and then everything crumbles. No, there's still the same margins that might have been overlooked are the ones that are going to come back and save you because the networks are still there.
Now, we're sort of coming down to the end of the chat. And I mean, it's something that we've talked about. We've been hitting on this, on the nail of not just literature, but also this idea of public health. And I want to sort of close off with what this story can do and what it can offer.
So I'm going to stand up for our health practitioners a little bit. partly because, and I don't know if I mentioned this to you before, I'm not medical myself, but in my work as a research consultant with socioeconomic projects, I've had occasion to, we did a project on the Millennium Development Goals, and I had the section to deal with health. So that was around the time, I don't remember, we had a chikungunya outbreak. One thing that happened with COVID, and of course COVID was unprecedented for all of us, was that the decision was made to keep COVID out of the one hospital that we had. Instead of trying to deal with it while it's in the hospital, it was like, no, we can't deal with it. Now, at this, I should mention that we already had a clinic for contagious cases, highly contagious cases, that was made around the time that, remember when Ebola was a thing, when SARS was a thing? So there was already a 6-bed unit that was separate and ready for that, but we knew we had to have a bigger number. Somehow, both the political will, the corporate will, and whatever will was needed and resources were needed, they built an entire new hospital in the North Parish in St. Lucie, just for COVID patients. As a region, we've still managed to be taking this a lot more seriously, taking this with a lot more caution than some other countries did, because maybe they thought their size would save them, maybe they thought that their resources, the level of development would save them. We know what it's like to deal with crises already. We know what it's like to deal with disasters. I almost more want to say, what stories can I write to highlight to people that this is the job that you're doing, that people are quietly saving our lives every day, and we don't even realize it.
I like that. So maybe hope is the message. Which really fits in well with the anthology's title, Take Us to a Better Place. So we've come to the end of the chat. Karen, I want to thank you so much for doing this. As I said at the beginning, it was only fitting that I have you on the podcast. Any final words?
I just want to say thank you so much for allowing me to ramble enthusiastically about something I feel quite passionate about. And I just want to encourage everyone who is listening to just, if you have a limited view of what speculative fiction is, I ask you to discard it now and to go and look at what so many Caribbean writers of note are doing. And especially, I think there's something very special about speculative fiction that looks at our future. We've had a lot of literature that looks at our past, that reckons with our past, and that's important. But I think we need to give that same level of energy to the literature that looks at our future, because that's what's ahead of us. That's there for the next generation. And there's a colleague of mine, Tobias Bakel, he has the best quote for this. He said, if we don't imagine our own future, somebody else is going to be doing it for us.
Oh, you're giving me chills right now. So Again, I want to encourage our listeners, you can look out for that, the story, The Plague Doctors, in the new anthology set to be released, or you can revisit the current anthology, Take Us to a Better Place.
Which I should have mentioned is free, available for free on the internet.
So once again, thank you very much, Karen, and thank you to all our listeners. Join us on the next episode of the Caribbean Science Fiction Network. Bye.